All right. Well, we're continuing in the book of Job this morning, if you want to grab your Bibles. And in the Old Testament, there is a group of books. I'm going to move this, Scott, if that's all right, so I'm not staring at it over here. There's a group of books in the Old Testament that are known as what's called wisdom literature. And wisdom literature reveals to us the universe that we live in, the world that we live in, isn't just governed by physical laws. Yeah, you can study physics and astronomy and the sciences and things like that, and you will learn physical laws, which God governs, right? But wisdom literature goes beyond that, and in a world that is influenced by physical law, what wisdom literature teaches us that this world is governed by moral law. And there's a very big difference. When God founded the earth, when he created all of this, he placed a moral fabric in his creation, all throughout creation. And if we live in accordance with the moral law, things will go better if we choose to live by it. If we choose to reject it, things are going to go very, very differently. Now, probably the most common wisdom book that there is, that people know most about, is Proverbs. Proverbs is a book that contains short, clever statements, and they're easy to remember. And Proverbs, also as a wisdom literature book, reveal to us this moral fabric that exists in our universe. Proverbs is full of little truisms that we can hang on to, little nuggets. And a truism is something that is typically true, not absolutely every single time, but typically true. Let me give an example here. We'll put it up on the screen. Proverbs 12:11 says, "He who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who pursues worthless things lacks sense." So it's also a book of poetry, just like Job that we're in. It is also a wisdom literature. It has a truism to it because it is typically true that if you work your land, or in some cases you don't have land, you have an urban-type job, right? If you work your job, you're going to have bread. It's not an absolute guarantee. It's not always going to be true. But what these proverbs do is they deal with real life. And they give us good judgments. They give us principles to live by. And they also affect our perception or our worldview. They often, very very frequently, will draw a distinction between a wise man and a foolish man. And they'll use parable-type examples. So the book of Proverbs lays out this moral framework, fabric for us. And that's what the Old Testament calls wisdom. A problem is that Christians, as Christians, we don't often grasp that the book of Proverbs is a book of principles, and it lays down how the moral law governs, but it's not a book of rock-solid principles, where if you do something, always do this thing, it will always, with certainty, always come out this way. Oftentimes we forget that, but this is where the book of Job comes in. The book of Job is where more than anyone on earth, God himself said that Job was blameless and he was upright. He feared God, he said, and he turned away from evil. And we're going to see today a very good example of wisdom. There was nobody at the time that lived more wisely than Job on the earth, except the struggle is this humongous tragedy comes to him. In one day, he lost all of his possessions. All 10 of his children died in one day. I can't even imagine bearing one child, let alone having to do 10 in a day. He lost his health. He was afflicted with boils all over, head to toe, pussy boils. In fact, he was so disfigured that when his friends showed up to try and help him and comfort him, they couldn't even recognize him. That's how bad he was. And to make matters worse, in the middle of all this suffering, his wife turns on him and tells him, look, just curse God so that he'll kill you. I wonder if she was really saying, look, curse God so that you get put out of my misery, right? She just absolutely turns on him. And then his three so-called friends show up, and they start talking to him. But his friends were operating with a different perception, a different worldview. And they were operating from a place where they would take some of those proverbs, those principles, and turn it into wisdom. But they turned those principles into absolutes. Every single time it happens this way. This is how I think how I can show how their minds worked. Basically, they thought, okay, we know that if you do what's right, you're going to be blessed. And if you do what's wrong, you're going to reap what you sow. Therefore, because you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. They took a proverb and turned it into an absolute principle. Here's an example, Proverbs 3:33. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Why do people, and including Job's friends, why do they think this way? I think it's really, it's an attempt to control our circumstances. As we look at this chaotic, suffering world, we like to take those proverbs and try and turn them into rock-solid principles. We want to think that if I just take care of my own business, if I do what I'm supposed to do, if I follow the Lord, and then everything will turn out for me. Everything will turn out okay for my family. I will receive all of these blessings. But that's not always true. That's the health and wealth gospel. That's the false gospel that's out there today. Just do all the good things, right? It's a work sanctification. May already be saved, so they haven't worked to get their salvation. But now they're trying to work to get blessings. It's a false gospel. That's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because look at Job. He did everything he could to follow the Lord, and everything went wrong for him. And so after months and months, I suppose, of Job's suffering and listening to his friends keep telling him, Job, it's your fault. Job, it's your fault. Job, it's your fault. You got to just deal with this, Job. Deal rightly with the Lord so that he can get back to blessing you again. But as we're 30 chapters into the book, we see that Job is no closer. After all of these cycles of his friends keep telling him, you got to do this, you got to do this, it's your fault, it's your fault. Job isn't any closer to having an answer. He's still frustrated. He's in deep grief, and his grief is deep. Remember back to chapter 3. Job said, "For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me." Basically, what Job is saying there is, all of my nightmares have come true. I couldn't even imagine this happening to me and losing all of this. My worst fears have come true. That's the life that he's living right then. And then as he goes through this, he's asking seriously deep questions. And one of the questions is one that really drives the entire book. Back in chapter 3 again. He said, why is light given to him who suffers and life to the bitter of soul? That's Job's question. Why, God, would you allow people to be born into life when all they're going to do is suffer? Why would you do that? Wouldn't it have been much better for me that I was never born? We're going to find out this morning that after all this time and after all this friend's advice, and after he keeps crying out to God for answers, God is still silent. And in the midst of God's silence, in the midst of all this bad advice he's getting from his friends, we see that answers continue to escape Job. And it adds to his anguish and his anger. We see it overflowing from him today. He actually gets to a place where he begins to curse God. I shouldn't say curse, that's probably too big of a word. Accuse God, that's probably a better word. He's accusing God, we'll read this in the text. But that's what we're going to find out in this section today. So if you would, let's turn to Job. We're going to be in chapters 26 through 31. And I'm going to do it a little bit differently today. We're not going to read every single verse. We're going to read most verses in a couple of the chapters. But I'm going to give you some highlights and some summaries as well, too, just for the interest of time. But as we look at this chunk, and I said earlier in the service that these, certainly the five chapters of 27 through 31 all go together, and I'll explain why. But we need to pick up 26. We don't want to skip over that. But if we look at the very last verse in chapter 31, those will be Job's last words in this book on this topic. It'll be his last words about his suffering. And it'll be his last words that in the light of this perceived silence of God, Job wants his questions answered. And I don't think this is an unusual response. If you've ever been in suffering or in a place where you've been crying out to the Lord for something, maybe you were in it month after month. For some of you, maybe year after year. And maybe along the way, at times, God appeared to be silent. I don't think it's an unusual response to be so anguished. I don't think it's an unusual response for people to accuse God of things. I think definitely there are some things that each of us can learn from Job this morning. So we're going to go over a bunch of chapters here, but let me just quickly, very quickly summarize what we're going to be looking at. So in chapter 26, we're going to hear Job's brief response to Bildad's last speech and the accusations again at Job. Remember, we've already seen two full cycles of his three friends coming one by one and talking to Job and accusing him and having some bad theology, and then we see Job's response. So we have seen this two full cycles now. We're in the third cycle, and this is the end of the third cycle. We should be having Zophar talk after Bildad does, but he doesn't. He's silent. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. Then in chapter 27, we'll see sort of Job's like final denouncement of his friend's bad advice. And then in 28, Job describes this search for wisdom. This is, I think, one of the most interesting chapters in this entire book. And then in 29 through 31, quickly, we'll look at how Job literally demands an explanation from God. So let's kick it off here. The first four verses of 26. So remember, Bildad has spoken. He's brought forth this same theology, bad theology of the day, that if you're suffering, you can't be innocent. God must be punishing you. Says, then Job responded, what a help you are to the weak. How have you saved the arm without strength? What counsel have you given to one without wisdom? What helpful insight have you abundantly provided? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit was expressed through you? Job here is, he's not only rebuking Bildad, he's also mocking him. I don't know if you could sense that the sarcasm that was in there. What a help you are to the weak, exclamation point. This is a real life struggle. And Job is responding to Bildad's lack of concern for him. Bildad just wanted to be right. Have you ever known somebody like that? Or maybe you've been like that at times. Many people treat a conversation like it's a competitive sport. Whoever says the most, whoever has the most clever points, whoever speaks the loudest or the longest is the winner. All of us, I think, fall into this trap at times. I have a good friend. He's a brother in Christ. There's no doubt in my mind that he's saved. And we go round and round on this because all he wants to do is be right. It doesn't matter what the other person hears or feels after the conversation, especially a non-believer. He just wants to be right all the time. Job here is showing his friend, Bildad, that his theological and his rational words miss the point altogether. He's been no help. Bildad has done, and the friends have done nothing to help out Job in his physical needs, his emotional needs, or his spiritual needs. And then in the rest of 26, we won't read it because we've heard this several times. It's almost identical to what we read in chapters 9 and 12. But Job goes on. First, he rebukes his friend, and then he goes on and he talks about, in the rest of the chapter, about the greatness of God, the power of God, the majesty of God. I encourage you to read the rest of 26 this week. And as I said before, right here, right, after Job has spoke, we should now hear Zophar come back and finish out that third cycle. That would be consistent. Because we've seen each cycle, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar. Now in the third cycle, Eliphaz, Bildad, no Zophar. Two full cycles have happened. But after Job rebukes Bildad, all of a sudden Zophar is silent. There's a lot, you can speculate all kinds of things here, right? Zophar heard, you know, what Bildad said and how Job rebuked him. And Zophar just didn't have it in him to argue anymore. So Job continues on in chapter 27, and he denounces his friend's advice. But he does it in a very interesting way. Listen to this. Then Job continued his discourse and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul? For as long as life is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I will hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days." Straight up, Job declares he is not going to bend his integrity. He's not going to move it. He will not give in to the pressure of this common theology of the day. He's not going to give in to the pressure of his friends. And he's not going to lie. He's going to hold to the truth. I think this is a great lesson for all of us. Because we have forces of opposition around us all the time. They might be the world, they might be society, right? It might be right inside of our own household, our own family. But when everything seems like it's up against you, hold on to what you know is true. Never, as Churchill said, never, never, never give up. Don't ever let go with what is right and what is true. Job is telling his friends, look, I'm gonna hold fast to my righteousness. He's not going to let his heart be swayed by his friends pressuring him. He's going to call sin, sin. And he's going to call righteousness, righteousness. He's going to hold fast. He's going to remain faithful. And he set an example for all of us. In the New Testament, James chapter 5, remember this verse? "We count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful." So I don't know how many, it was probably somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 years later, they're pointing back to Job saying, remember the endurance of Job. He stuck to the truth. And then in verse 7, Job pulls the pin and goes on the offensive. He says, "May my enemy, you, my friend, be as the wicked. May my opponent, you guys, be as the unjust. For what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off? When God requires his life, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call on God at all times?" Basically, what Job is telling his buddies is, "Look, you better get your act together, because when distress does come upon you, and you haven't been following the Lord, he's not going to listen to you. You guys are acting like fools. I know my circumstance. I know that I'm innocent. And I know that you're condemning me unjustly." And then what he does in the rest of chapter 7 is that he warns of what's going to happen to them if they continue to act in rebellion of God, if they continue to speak about God in untruths. Ironically, what he talks about is exactly what's happening to him is going to happen to them if they don't change their ways. He says, "You guys are liars, but I'm not going to lie. And you better get your act together, because God is going to judge those who wrongly accuse others." Remember the Ten Commandments, right? One of them is, I shall not bear false witness, right? Accuse someone unjustly. So after declaring that they have been speaking falsely, he transitions into this beautiful talk. It's a search for wisdom. And I'll be honest with you, I got hung up mostly on this one chapter in this block. Chapter 28 is an interesting chapter because it's unlike any other chapter in the book. It has a very different tone to it. Some scholars have speculated that there might, because we don't know who wrote the book. Some scholars have speculated, was this a narrator, or was this actually Job speaking? Did he write it? Nobody really knows. But it's like Job was saying, okay, you guys don't have any wisdom. You guys don't know how this world functions. So if that's the case, then how do you find wisdom? So he talks about this search for wisdom. And he does it in an interesting way. He starts out by talking about man's quest for valuable things. It says this in 28, surely there is a mine for silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from rock. Man puts an end to darkness, and to the farthest limit he searches out the rock and gloom, searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro from men. The earth, from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Its rocks are the sources of sapphires, and its dust contains gold. The path no bird of prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the base. He hews out channels through the rocks, and his eye sees anything precious. He dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light. So Job starts out, old man is right. He starts out talking, now think about the context here, right? He is talking about mining, driving shafts in the ground, right? We know that this book was written back mid-Genesis, somewhere back in there. But he starts talking about this quest for silver and gold and sapphires and iron and copper. And he says, with all this human ingenuity, and at the time he was talking about the pinnacle of human ingenuity, we have all this ingenuity to pursue all of these things of value. We have all this creativity and all this skill to find gold. But he says, but where do we find wisdom? In verse 12, he goes on, but where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? You can dig to the heart of the earth and you can find gold. But are you going to find wisdom there? Verse 13, man does not know its value, nor it is found in the land of the living. You can go to the smallest, look at the smallest part of an atom and learn all the intricacies of the how God crafted this all together, but you're not going to find wisdom there. You're not going to find this knowledge on how to live in this world by God's standard, appropriately, and live well. Verse 14, the deep says it is not in me, and the sea says it is not in me. We could understand all of the fascinating intricacies of the ocean. We could dive to the deepest parts of it. We could map it out, take photographs of animals that have never seen daylight before. And you're not going to ever find an ounce of wisdom there. Verse 15, pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed at its price. No matter how much money you have, you will never be able to buy wisdom. And then in verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and death say, Abaddon is another word for destruction. Destruction and death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it. So what he's saying here is that wisdom is actually concealed from us, from each one of our lives. He even says that if you could cross over death, if you could cross over the veil of death and talk to people on the other side, they would say they simply have heard about it. there's been a rumor of something called wisdom. So if wisdom escapes us, the living, then where is the hope? Where are we to ever find wisdom? Verse 23, God understands its way, and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. Job understands the sovereignty of God. When he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure, when he set a limit for the rain and a course for the thunderbolt, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and also searched it out. What Job is saying is that the way you find wisdom, it isn't by seeking out everything in this world. It's by knowing God. Because God, it's God in whom all wisdom resides. This is one of the overarching messages of the book of Job. And this actually came from a fellow pastor in our network, our Creekside Community Church up in McMinnville, Oregon. I heard Pastor Steve Mansour say this. He said, the answers aren't found in asking why, but in knowing who. Let me say that again. The answers aren't found in asking why, but in knowing who. If you had all the answers, if you were able to find out everything that could be found out, wisdom will escape you, because wisdom is found in God alone. And he says this, and he defines it for us. And in verse 28, it's actually God speaking, and to man, he, the Lord, this is what he said. And to man, he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. What is the fear of the Lord? It's kind of a hard thing to kind of nail down, but here's the best description I have heard. The fear of the Lord is, quote, the affectionate reverence by which the child of God humbly submits himself to the Father's will. It's not being terrified of him. It's not being, you know, he's going to, you know, zap me with a lightning bolt and kill me, right? The fear of the Lord is the affectionate reverence by which the child of God humbly submits himself to the Father's will. You can have all the questions in the world and have all these unanswered questions about this world, but if you really want to live well, if you really want to live well in this world, you need to have that affection, that reverence of God. And in that, you will humbly submit to his will. And as you turn from evil, as you turn from your sin, you will seek, that's a natural response, you will seek out how to follow the Lord, how to honor him. And that's where wisdom is found. So if you want to live well in this world, honor the Lord. Turn from evil and turn towards him. Now, this is something that we as humans naturally push back against. We want to have easy answers. And I think we want to have easy answers to give us a sort of a sense of control. And if we're in control, then now God is obligated to somehow perform things in our life to make things better. Do you remember Satan's challenge at the very beginning of the book? What did he say? He said, the only reason that why Job worships you, God, is because you give him all of this stuff, right? You just pile all this stuff, these blessings upon him. Satan said, if you take away all that stuff from him, he will stop worshiping you. And Job lost everything, everything. Yet, we see throughout the book, even though he's struggling, even though he's in a trial, even though he's got questions, even though he thinks that God is silent, he continues to worship him in the midst of all of his anguish. And even if he makes accusations against God, there's still this core faith that never leaves, where Job understands that God is sovereign and he is in control. Even though I can't understand it right now, he hung on to that faith. Chapter 28 is a moment right in a little bit past the middle of the book a moment of wisdom and insight. And for a brief moment, Job's eyes aren't on himself. They're solely on God. But in chapter 29, Job's eyes get turned back onto himself, and he starts reminiscing about what it used to be like when God did pour out all these blessings on him. Chapter 29, and Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in the months gone by, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. As I was in the prime of my days, when the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, and my children were around me." He's saying, I remember those days. It was awesome. God's favor was all over me, and my children were all around me, and we were celebrating, having feasts. He's reminiscing about all these the blessings that God had given him. But as we continue on in 29, we start hearing that the blessings that Job had weren't just the things that God had given him. What he says is he was blessed not because of what he received, but because of how he acted towards other people. I think this is very important for us to grasp, because in our world, in our culture, in our society, the blessing is always me. Me, me, me. I get this. I have this. I have a new that, right? Bigger house, whatever it may be. We think that God's blessing is for us, but it isn't. God blesses us so that we can be a blessing to other people. Verse 11, "For when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of one ready to perish came upon me, and I made the widow's heart sing for joy." He says, I was blessed because I was able to be a blessing to other people. I cared for the poor. I cared for the widow. I cared for those who were about to be killed. I protected life. He goes on, "I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I investigated the case which I did not know. I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth." Job realizes that God was blessing him because he was a blessing to other people. But then in chapter 30, he starts on where he is now. He says, "But now those younger than I mock me, whose fathers I disdain to put with the dogs of my flock. Indeed, what good was the strength of their hands to me? Vigor had perished from them." And in verse 9, "And now I have become their taunt. I have even become a byword to them." What does that mean? I had to look it up. A byword is like, if you want, it's, we had a joke in my unit in the military that it's good that if your name ever becomes a noun, it's bad if your name ever becomes a verb, right? Like, you're so marked up, it's not even funny, right? Okay, you get the idea, right? This is what this byword is, right? Byword here is you would curse somebody in the name of somebody, right? Like, man, you're so jobed up, it's not even funny. I curse you in the name of Job. That's a byword. That's where he's at. And they mock you. Verse 10, "They abhor me, they hate me, and they stand aloof from me, and they do not refrain from spitting at my face. Because he has loosed his bowstring and afflicted me." Again, he's thinking here, because of the silence, that God is the one who's punishing him. "They have cast off the bridle before me. On the right hand, their brood arises. They thrust aside my feet and build up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They profit from my destruction. No one restrains them. As though a wide breach, they come. Amidst the tempest, they roll on. Terrors are turned against me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud." This is Job's lot. After everything he's done for all these people around him, he is mourning, he's in grief, because it appears like there's this massive amount of injustice that's happened to him. His entire worldview is shattered by what he thinks are God's actions. He goes on, "I cry out to you for help, but you do not answer me. I stand up and you turn your attention against me. You have become cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride, and you dissolve me like a storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house of meeting for all living. God, what am I supposed to do? You've afflicted me. I expected good to come, but evil came. I expected light, but now I'm in darkness. And so in chapter 31, Job demands an explanation from God. He demands a response. He's going through. He's going to go through all these areas of his righteousness. He's going to make his case, and he's literally going to challenge God to bring a charge against him. Verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? He starts off by saying, look, my heart has been pure. I've made a covenant with my eyes. I have not looked at another woman with lust. I've been faithful to my wife. And then in verse 9, he talks about adultery. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or I have lurked at my neighbor's doorway, may my wife grind for another and let others kneel down over her. For that would be a lustful crime. Moreover, it would be an iniquity punishable by judges. Job is not saying, look, I'm sinless. He's saying, I'm innocent. God, no matter what judgment you can bring against me, it would be an unjust judgment because I have been faithful to my wife. And he goes on, if I have despised the claim of my male or female slaves when they had filed a complaint against me, what then could I do when God arises and when he calls me to account? What will I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him, and the same one fashion us in the womb? Job brings this is an interesting section here. He's saying that righteousness is characterized by not rejecting the complaint of one of your slaves, that you listen to their complaint. Now, this word slaves, right, in context, is not like what we had, like American slavery, right, with Africa, bringing African Americans here. It's a different type. It's a master and a servant relationship. And actually, the slave chooses to come under a master. But this is interesting here. For the first time in the Old Testament, you see a both male and female brought up. Well, I shouldn't say that. Genesis, right? Okay, forget that. We're editing that part out of the audio. But we see here, right, that Job brings up, it doesn't matter whether they're male or female. He says, it's right because God made me and God made each of them, that we're all equal. From the very beginning in Genesis, into Job, God stresses, he affirms equality. He continues in verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire, or I have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the orphan has not shared it. But from my youth he grew up with me as with a father, and from infancy I guided her. Again, notice the comparison or the equality there. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or that the needy had no covering, if his loins have not thanked me, and if he has not been warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the orphan because I saw I had to support in the gate, let my shoulder fall from the socket and my arm be broken off at the elbow. For calamity from God is a terror to me, and because of his mercy I can do nothing. Job literally says, he's making his case, if I haven't cared for the needy, if I didn't invite the hungry to come in and eat with me, then he says, break my arm at the elbow and dislocate it from its socket. Rip it out. Job just keeps asserting his innocence, but the injustice keeps coming on him again and again and again. He's saying that when I get to stand before God, I will be declared righteous. In all of this that's happening to me, all of this will be proven that it's not the result of a direct sin in my life. Again, he's not saying that he's perfect, but he is saying that he has feared the Lord. He has departed from evil. He has lived with integrity and in uprightness. So what do we do with all of that? What do you do when you're in those situations when life doesn't make sense? And where hardship seems like it just keeps coming and coming in. When your marriage isn't working out right. When there's problems with your kids. When your job isn't just working out at all. What do we do when God seems like he's idle? No matter how much we appeal to him and cry out to him. One thing I think it's important to realize, do you understand what Job doesn't understand? He does understand that that to stand before God was right, and his desire to have understanding and wisdom found in God was right. But we know what Job doesn't understand. We can understand that God's wisdom is found in himself, because God's wisdom was put on display when God was put on trial. Put on trial, Mark, what do you mean? I mean, that's not, where do you find that in the book of Job? It's not in the book of Job. But years later, God himself came down to earth in human flesh, and he was put on trial. And instead of defending himself, what did he do? He allowed himself to be wrongly condemned. Because God allowed himself to be executed, God is not indifferent about the suffering of humanity. In fact, it says both in the scriptures, in both the Old Testament and New Testament, that God specifically came to earth so that he could walk in that suffering and he could bear it himself. That's where true wisdom is from. Colossians 2, verse 2, that their hearts may be encouraged, having been knit together in love, and attaining to all the wealth that comes from the full assurance of understanding, resulting in the true knowledge of God's mystery, that is Christ himself, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Resulting in a true knowledge of God's mystery, that is Christ himself, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. You want to find wisdom? It's found in Christ. Now, we will always have principles for how to live right. And you may come to church and say, well, I'm not really here for Job, right? I would just like the 7 easy principles on how to live a fabulous life. And just tell me how I can tick these things off. Make the list, and how I can tick these things off, and I can have a happy life. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. But that's exactly what Job's friends, that's how they thought. Job, you must have skipped step number 4, right? You did it in the wrong order, right? Or you missed one or something. And now your life stinks. In Jesus are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Listen to what Paul wrote to the church in Corinth in his first letter. He said, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness." Until we grasp the role of Jesus Christ, until we grasp the cross and trust in him and follow him, we're never going to be able to live well, no matter how many principles we have. So what does that mean for you and me? For if you came here this morning thinking that, well, I need to log some time in church, right? I got to get my church hours up a little bit. Then if I do that, then God is somehow going to make my life better for me. That's not how it works. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad that you're here. Please don't stop coming to church, okay? But know that it's in Jesus. That's where all the hidden treasures are. That's where the wisdom and that's where the knowledge is. And so I think our challenge is that we should have that affectionate reverence for the Lord because of what he's done in Jesus Christ. And we should turn from evil. And as we're turning from evil, that's when real life comes in. For those of us that are Christians here today, and when we're in the middle of a crisis of any kind, we need to understand that Jesus is going to call on us to follow him in that trial. He came and he endured the cross, and he calls us each day to do the exact same thing. It's in following Jesus Christ, in taking up the cross, in obeying him regardless of what happens, and worshiping him regardless of what happens. But don't forget this last piece. With the cross comes the resurrection. One day Jesus will return, and he will make all things right. He will restore everything back to the garden, pre-fall. But for now, as we walk out our Christian walk, as we walk out this life, don't ever forget that grace is available to you every single day. He is here. He's alive. And he's here alive to forgive you. And he is not indifferent to my suffering or your suffering or the sufferings of this world. And we know from Scripture that he loves us. One last text here, also from that first letter to the Corinthians. For consider your calling, brethren, brothers and sisters, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are. So that no man may boast before God, but by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. So that, just as it is written, let him who boasts boast in the Lord. Amen.